This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
I've heard your question. I'm answering you. Yes. Thank you. I've heard your question. Let me answer you.
We have Muslims saving the Jews in Bosnia. This is important information. You need to get out.
Did you know that Muslims around the world protected hundreds of thousands of Jews from being killed by the Nazis?
Protecting the Jews, wearing the niqab.
Muslims would put this on the Jews.
Let me speak, please. I'm in charge here.
This was shocking here. The Serbian Chechnya has joined the Israeli army to participate in the genocide in Palestine and Gaza. This is the ISIS of the Serbian nation?
It is.
You want to crucify me because I say this was not just.
Don't forget, Bosnia had four well-documented crusades.
This is the Deen Show. Assalamu alaikum. Greetings of peace. My next guest, Irfan Mirza, is a two-time international award-winning writer. His latest work is entitled The History of Bosnia and Herzegovina, a body of work that has been praised by former president of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Dr. Haris Selajic, amongst others. He is an academic historian from the Bosnian American Institute. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you know that Holocaust denial is illegal in several countries, mainly in Europe? And in many cases, it carries criminal penalties, including prison time. Now, what does the word Holocaust actually mean? It comes from the Greek word Holokoston, which means burnt whole or completely burnt. Over time, the word Holocaust came to describe any large scale of destruction, particularly by fire. By the mid-20th century, it was used to refer to massive devastating events, especially those involved in large-scale loss of life. That's exactly what's happening right now in Gaza and what's happened in Bosnia. But you got people denying what happened in Bosnia, refusing to call it what it was. So I'm going to get into this next clip, and then I'm going to bring out my next guest to comment, to react to it, and we'll take it from there.
Wait, I know what is your question, and I'm answering you. I am answering you. Let me answer you. I've heard your question. I'm answering you. Yes. Thank you. I've heard your question. Let me answer you. I'm fed up. What I said was that this was not genocide. I didn't say it was not a massacre. Let me speak, please. Let me speak, please. I'm in charge here. I never said there was no massacre. Of course there was a massacre. But you want to hang me because I say this was not genocide. You want to hang me. You want to crucify me because I say this was not genocide.
Peace of peace. Assalamu alaikum. Irfan, Kakosi, how are you?
Dobro falo, welcome, salam. Nice to meet you, Edin, and a pleasure to be on your show.
Nice to have you. Thank you for accepting. And I'd like to get into this, as you heard me open up, the denial. If you were to go ahead and to deny the Holocaust, it's a fact in many countries, you can go to jail. It carries very grave consequences. But how about here now in Bosnia? When you've heard a clip like this, and this person has not retracted yet, you've done some tremendous, amazing work. And your background, were you born in Bosnia? Are you originally from Bosnia?
No, I'm originally from India.
From India. So that's my first question before you react to that. How does someone from India get to be a historian and doing some wonderful work now to educate the people on this horrible, evil event that took place?
So in 1992, when the war started in Bosnia, it really piqued my interest because I realized that this was not an ordinary military action or a skirmish of some kind or some sort of a civil war. So I went over there and I spent a considerable amount of time a little over 2 years, crisscrossing the front lines of the war, and I had a chance to see a lot for myself. So I had at the time what I would call firsthand information about what was happening in Bosnia. certainly the situation, the crisis, the humanitarian crisis, the relief crisis, the political crisis, they were all coming together, you know, in various towns. And then I saw how the defense of Bosnia was being attacked in so many different ways of the Bosnian people. I started to understand the differences between the militias, who was forming on what side, what their political objectives were. And then having seen tragedy, so much tragedy over that period, I just had to understand a lot more about what was the root cause of this. I had to understand what the motives were, what were the objectives of the people who were involved in this. And then I had to do something about it. And, you know, in my personal belief, if you can help somebody physically, it's the right thing to do. If you can't even do that, then at least speak about it, learn about it, educate others. And that's kind of where we're at. And so it's been almost a more than a 30-year cycle for me, where I'm going on to my sort of 32nd year of engagement with Bosnia-Herzegovina in a deep way. So after spending 30 years on a topic, you kind of get to know a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So the Imran Hussein, who mentions that they want to crucify me or hang me, or we don't want to do any of that. We just want to educate him, and others like him that might have this view that this didn't actually happen. It wasn't a genocide. How would you respond to that?
Well,
and the difference between saying it's a massacre versus, you know, the semantics here, you know, trying to downgrade it, and what's the significance of downgrading it?
So we have to keep in mind that the phrase genocide, the word genocide, has been very clearly defined by United Nations Convention that was drafted in the late 1940s by Raphael Lemkin. He was an attorney in the U.S. and after the Holocaust, he felt that the United Nations needed to have a convention, at least on genocide, so that we could understand it and that we had a legal definition for it. So today, genocide is used in many ways. There is an entire framework, if you want to call it that, to understand it. Courts apply this framework very, very judiciously, meaning that they follow a very disciplined set of interrogations to determine what constitutes genocide. In the case of Bosnia-Herzegovina, there are 25,000 pages, literally 25,000 pages of testimony in a single trial, in the trial of Radovan Karadzic alone, that point to the commitment of genocide. There are cases from Doboj, from Zepa, from in Germany, in so many different situations where genocide was clearly identified, not just in Srebrenica, but also in other places in Bosnia-Herzegovina. My view and interpretation of the Genocide Convention is that all of Bosnia was facing genocide, and all Bosniak people were facing genocide during that war from the outset all the way through to the Dayton Peace Agreement that was signed late in 1995.
Now, why was it, when you say that all, but why was it restricted just to Srebrenica?
So the legal definition in the International Court was heavily focused on Srebrenica. I don't think it's fair to say that it was restricted to Srebrenica. It was focused on Srebrenica because we had the strongest amount of evidence and testimony that came from there. Perhaps Srebrenica, you could call it as the capstone of what the Chetniks had done over the course of the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So the International Court focused on that and found Radovan Karadzic guilty of it, as well as other cohorts in the military, such as Mladic, General Ratko Mladic. So the common understanding of genocide is that when you try to target an ethnic group, a religious group, a group that has some type of affinity, and in Srebrenica, boys and men were separated from women. The court very clearly called that out as a clear piece of evidence of genocide. The goal was to make sure that the men were eradicated, and it was to make 8,500 boys and men separated from women. The men were massacred. The males were massacred as young as 3 years old, as old as 93 years. And the goal of such a massacre is to ensure that that population no longer is able to continue or procreate any further. That's an act of genocide.
I want to go ahead and share this clip now from the, I think this is the current president of the RS, who's clearly stating what you're stating.
Ja znam savršeno dobro šta je bilo. Bio je genocid u Srebrenici. To je presudio sud u Hagu. I to je nesporna pravna činjenica.
You know who this person is, correct?
Yeah, it is. It's Milorad Dodik.
Yeah. So you heard what he said. This is undeniable. This was a genocide, correct? But then if someone like, go ahead, what were you going to say?
No, that was it. I'm listening.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so you have someone like this. This is, for people that don't know, this was because in Bosnia, it kind of gets, for people visiting the first time, I brought some friends over from the UK and I showed them around, and it's kind of people, you know, when you get there, it's kind of confusing for a lot of people to have a country kind of, how would you break down in layman's terms to give a simple, dumbed down explanation of when you say there's a country almost like inside of a country, how do you help people to understand that?
So what we're now talking about is sort of a political structure. One of the compromises that was made during the Dayton peace process from all sides was that Bosnia's sovereignty was protected by Dayton, Bosnia as a sort of a federal state. But in order to do that, the militaries that were engaged, militias from Croatia, militias from Serbia, from what they called at the time New Yugoslavia, Serbia and Montenegro, were active and present in Bosnia. The presidents of these countries at the time, Franjo Tuđman of Croatia and Slobodan Milošević of Serbia, were both actively responsible for military intervention and support of militias in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So in order to strike a peace deal to end the war, the negotiating team that Bill Clinton, U.S. President Bill Clinton had sent, had to come up with compromises that would give autonomy or some degree of power to the forces, the military forces that were there. Now, in a peace deal, military really can't have authority because you end up with militarism or military rule. So what they did is they developed these sort of civilian proxies that would then influence the militias. And those civilian proxies then formed this entity structure that you're trying to describe, which is a country within a country. RS is not a country. It is assured by the Dayton Peace Agreement and by the Peace Implementation Council of never achieving the status of a country. It is an entity. You could describe it as a province or a state within a country. The country is Bosnia and Herzegovina, and that country is guaranteed by international law to continue to exist. So what RS is a political entity that sits within the framework of Bosnia and Herzegovina, much as the Federation is a political entity that sits within the framework of Bosnia and Herzegovina.
So the person in the video, he was the president. Is he currently the president now still?
No, he was the president of
the
Republika Srpska, correct.
So at that time when this clip came out, he was here very lucidly stating that this was what we're talking about, very clearly. Later he came and he took back his statement. Is that right?
Yeah, so political statements are made in expediencies, whatever goal they're trying to achieve for that very short term, the sort of narrow-minded, narrow perspective, those statements are made at the time. I think, in general, acknowledgement of a leader or another leader of some kind, genocide that happened. It's not really material, because you know that they're making those statements at the time that they make them because they want some political gain. And then they retract those statements when there is a different political objective that they're trying to achieve. Genocide is something that all of humanity, international law, and the principles that govern our activities in hostile situations, the Geneva Convention, these are the instruments that you use to measure whether genocide was committed or not, not hyperbole or statements by political leaders. Those are hardly ever accurate.
Mm-hmm. So now when you come up with the 25,000 page documents, all of the witnesses that's come forth and, you know, the hearings, obviously at the end of the day, it was concluded what it is now. So now to have people come out and say that it wasn't, where does that leave you at? Thinking about the person's lack of knowledge, are they ignorant or...
Ignorance is generally where people come out and say, I don't know that genocide was committed. Please tell me about it. Most areas, like if you come to me and say, hey, how do you make, you know, tolumbe? It's a Bosnian dessert. I don't know how to make them. I won't deny that tolumbe exists. I will just say, I don't know how to make them.
Please. That's ignorance. You just don't know. But you're asking, you're sincerely asking, just teach me.
Correct. But in the case where somebody says genocide didn't happen, or they try to undermine its definition, or characterize it as a massacre, or characterize it as a, all sides committed war crimes, this is where you have to draw the line and say, no, wait, you must have a political objective that's causing you to do this, or you must be misinformed, severely misinformed in some way. Genocide denial is an intentional act. It's not a happenstance. It's not something that just, you know, I didn't study it, therefore I don't know, therefore I will deny it. It's never like that. In fact, it is described in many frameworks that study genocide as the final phase of genocide. It is described and considered by many in academia especially, as a continuation of the effects of genocide, and in some cases, a continuation of the genocide itself. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, when the Dayton Peace Agreements were signed in 1995, the apparatus that committed the genocide was never dismantled, right? The militaries were pulled away. Dayton called for very specific disarming and removal of weapons that could cause mass loss of life. But what never happened was the political structure that committed the genocide was never dismantled. Slobodan Milosevic, at the initial signing of Dayton, was a signer to Dayton. Imagine the head of the criminals coming to sign a peace agreement, in a way absolving himself of any involvement or responsibility, accountability, and then going back to office and sitting in the office of the president of Serbia and Montenegro. That apparatus was never dismantled. Mm-hmm. So that apparatus then, when it was sort of demilitarized, took on the next thing that it could, which was the propaganda machine to deny the genocide. First, to protect all of those who had committed it. And then when the international community finally caught up with them, Karadzic went to trial, Milosevic ended up in trial, Mladic ended up in trial, Tudjman ended up in trial. When all of these things happened, so when all of these things happened, the apparatus turned to genocide denial.
Now it's very sad when you have individuals who call to certain actions that are very extreme, and Muslims are the first to condemn certain groups that we've heard all, you know, over the years, Daesh, ISIS, and whatnot. And you can imagine if you had a club, if you want to make that analogy, in America, you have one in Australia that's called a Chutney Club. But imagine if there was an ISIS club now, how would people view that? Would that be able to exist? I find that this group now, because there's a lot of good Serbs out there, Serbians, And so we want to distinguish. But the parallel and the analogy here is that you have this ideology, and you had many who committed terrorist acts in their manifestos. They would go ahead and be linked back to this group, kind of taking from their ideology. So they still exist. Can you comment and to help us understand this significance of this group, Chetniks, and what they want to accomplish, and why this, would you classify them as dangerous?
Oh, they're absolutely very dangerous. So let's be clear about sort of who committed the genocide and who it was against, mm-hmm. so that we understand at least that part of it.
Yes.
What I saw during the war with my own eyes as I was going through these front lines and, you know, tanks and howitzers and militias lined up, crisscrossing.
Firsthand, you were there firsthand witnessing this, huh?
Yeah, I was there from close to the beginning of the war in 1992 all the way through well into 1994. So about
you were actually there through the whole war. You were there in Bosnia.
Yeah, I was running a humanitarian mission, bringing in supplies and taking them to places where the United Nations forces couldn't take them or sending them there. So I had a chance to see this, and what I saw were military units that had come that had sort of the Yugoslavia logo insignia, and one day, and then a few days later, coming back to that same spot, trying to run my humanitarian convoys, the insignia had been torn off, but the soldiers were the same. So what had happened was clearly an act of aggression. Weapons and military forces had come across from outside of the borders of Bosnia-Herzegovina, engaged in military activity in Bosnia, committed atrocities, war crimes, massacres, and genocide, and then it sort of reshaped their identity so that they could appear to be locals. Ensuring that the international community would characterize what was happening in Bosnia-Herzegovina as a civil war. Serbia wanted to keep its hands clean in some way, but it didn't stop it or prevent it from continuing to supply weapons, military leadership, direction, and soldiers, feeding them into Bosnia, moving them from the former JNA, which was the Yugoslav People's Army, from places such as Montenegro, into key positions around Sarajevo, in Podrinja, all the way to Prijedor, Tomasica, the massacre that was committed there, another act of genocide in the municipalities around Prijedor. All of this was orchestrated very clearly by these militias, and the militias were revived, I guess, from the time of the Second World War. They were sort of rebranded as Chetniks. That's not inclusive of all Serbian people. There are many Serb victims in Bosnia and Herzegovina who died and were massacred at the hands of Chetniks. There are many what they call today Croats or Catholics in Bosnia and Herzegovina who were extirpated, who were also part of the ethnic cleansing that took place in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And obviously there were Muslims or Bosniaks who were the primary target of Chetnik activity. Chetniks had two goals. One goal was to commit genocide, meaning ethnically cleanse and extirpate, eradicate, biological extinction of the Muslim populations. The other goal that they had was a political goal, which was to divide Bosnia and Herzegovina so that there could be one component of it that would go to become a part of Greater Serbia. And as that goal formed, Croatian President Franjo Tuđman had relatively the same idea to take parts of Bosnia and Herzegovina and annex it for Croatia. So there were two primary goals that were being chased after. And the Chetniks were very clear in both of those, in that they wanted to commit genocide against the Bosniaks. And then the second one was that they wanted the territory of Bosnia and Herzegovina so that it could be controlled and integrated as part of Greater Serbia. Those two goals today continue. They have persisted. The Chetnik apparatus that committed these goals, the genocide and trying to divide Bosnia and Herzegovina continues to this day to do the same thing. So here we are, 30 days, Eddie, past the 30 years past the war, and we still see very strong influences, as you say, from different clubs, unfortunately, all over the world, continuing to sort of bite away and gnaw away at the sovereignty of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and indirectly threatening the biological existence of the Bosniak people. To this day, it continues, sadly.
So if anything was going to erupt, it erupts from this group, which is this a fair analogy to make? This is the ISIS of the Serbian nation?
It is that way. Politics have a very strong influence on all of these sort of groups. There are political objectives that Serbia today is trying to achieve. It's balancing itself between an alliance with Russia and an economic dependency on Europe. That political outcome that it's trying to achieve gives it incentive, I guess is the best way of putting it, to continue to undermine the sovereignty of Bosnia-Herzegovina, at least through its rhetoric, if not through through political and diplomatic means. Don't forget, Serbia and Croatia were Bosnia's enemies during the war, these two nation states. And today they are Bosnia's largest trading partners. So there's a dichotomy and a balancing act that Bosnia has to maintain in order to retain its economic viability. And at the same time, it continues to feel the pressures and the threats of this, these apparatuses that were set up both in Serbia as well as in Croatia to undermine its sovereignty. That apparatus has never been dismantled.
How much does religion play a role with the Chetniks?
So, you know, religion is something that you can have as a shroud that you can put on. It's an appearance. You can go to church and you can have, you know, all of the ritualistic components of religion. And then there's what's in your heart, what's in your faith, what's in your belief system, and what you do. Three different things, probably. And so when you say religion, look, there was a point when the Orthodox Church and the Patriarch had actually blessed the Serbian troops, the Chetnik troops, as they were going into Bosnia and Herzegovina to commit the genocide. I don't believe that's an act of faith. I think it's a ritual, and I think it had a political outcome that was certainly achieved. In order to commit genocide, you've got to convince a massive number of people to go and do this horrific acts of massacres and crimes against humanity, crimes that we call crimes against humanity. You have to empower them and psychologically brainwash them into going and doing these kinds of things. It's not in human nature to be this cruel, the degree of cruelty that it takes to commit genocide. And so that massive brainwashing, and one of the components of it was the blessing of the church to say that you're off to go and do a good thing. So we saw that. But if you ask me, is it in the Orthodox belief or the Orthodox Christian belief or the Catholic belief that Muslims need to be wiped out from Bosnia-Herzegovina or Bosniaks or from the face of the planet? No, I don't believe the doctrine of the faith calls for that. The faiths are relatively benevolent. It's the use of them, the rituals that are formed around them, and the political outcomes that they're used for. Don't forget, Bosnia had four well-documented crusades carried out against it in medieval times. Some historians count as many as 11 crusades carried out against it. And these were led by religious initiatives coming out of the Vatican. So faith has been hijacked. It's been used by these terrorist organizations that you describe them to rain mass terror. It's just another tool that they use in addition to guns, in addition to propaganda. So to say that religion had a role in it as a doctrine, I don't think so. But in the practice, Absolutely. It was hijacked and it was used for malicious purposes.
I don't know if you got a chance to see, maybe not, the interview I did, if you, someone ever shared it with you. I actually went to Republika Srpska and I sat with a Chetnik priest who was there, and he was someone who was higher up in the military, and I had a conversation with him, and I was bringing these points to light that if you're a priest, you should be preaching what Jesus, according to the Bible, is saying, to love your enemy, to love your neighbor, to turn the other cheek. What happened to that? And so he had a good conversation, but he didn't really have much of a response to that. He kind of went in circles. But I think this is what you exactly said, the hijacking, because if you want to be expounding now that Jesus is the epitome of love, of the Prince of Peace, what happened to him there in Bosnia? Yeah. So,
yeah, it's an interesting point. There's a small historical anecdote that I do want to share.
Please do.
In the 12th century, in the time of what Bosnians call Odkulin Bana I Dobri Dana, what that literally means is from the time of Kulin Ban and the good days, or we might take some liberal definition of it, interpretation, and say the good old days, the good old days of Kulin Ban. Those days are remembered in history and well documented by historians as perhaps Bosnia's golden era. And we attribute a lot of that golden era to Kulin Ban's foresight and his insight, and how he at age 16, took the helm of a nation that was crumbling and falling apart amid forces and enemies that wanted to destroy it. But the reality of it is that the original followers of Jesus, this message of peace that you're talking about, the Prince of Peace and compassion, that message from the time of Jesus had actually reached a group of a religious sect called the Bogomili. And Bogomili in Bulgaria were being persecuted simply because they were preaching this message of peace. And they took refuge in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the time of Kulin Ban. And that brought about the wrath of several popes, Pope Nicholas, Pope Alexander, Pope Innocent III, against Bosnia-Herzegovina to launch crusades to clean out sort of what they call these heretics. The only sort of heresy that they practiced was that they didn't adhere or follow the leadership of the church. They followed Jesus and his teachings as best as they understood them and knew them. And Bosnia was one of the last places on the planet where the followers of Jesus' original teachings found refuge, and Kulin Ban protected them. So now we come to talk about the Christians in Bosnia-Herzegovina sort of divided in that period in the 11th to 12th centuries between the East and the West, the schism that occurred between in the Roman Empire for creating the formation of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. Both are steeped in Jesus' teachings of peace. Sadly, those teachings were cast aside during this war, and political motives took over. So very clear as to what happened there.
I like what you put. They were cast aside. They were forgotten. They were totally, like, we took that part out of the Bible. It doesn't exist, but this is very important. I love this point that you made, the Bogomils. I mean, the true followers of Jesus, who believed in only one God, worshiped God like Jesus did. This was preserved now, and you have it there, and the Bosnians ended up accepting this message of pure monotheism there that was practiced by the Bogomils. They accepted Islam, and they were persecuted. So you can say the Muslim Bosnians, they are the ones who are holding on to the true teachings of Jesus, peace be upon them. And that's why the persecution has continued to go on. I want a couple more points before we conclude. I want to show you this. When I brought some guests over from the UK, and I shared some of the things that are happening, you know, got some history lesson. Then we did a reaction video, and I want to let you hear this song. To me, it was very shocking. There was some old songs, and then there's a new song that went viral. So we reacted to it, and I want you to go ahead and react to it. To me, I was shocked when I heard this. many of the Bosnians there, and I had an interview with a professor from the university, Professor Ahmed, and he was saying this is pretty much normal. They kind of got desensitized to some of these songs. This professor was telling me that he heard at another popular radio station something similar, not this exact same song. So I want to get your reaction to this.
I did either. I was born where there were no mosques, and I've hated Muslims ever since. I was born.
Yeah, keep translating for me. Yeah.
Do you think you won't take Bosnian Herzegovina into hell and Muslims maybe into extinction?
These are the war criminals.
The moment has arrived to take revenge against Turks in this region. My dad is a war criminal. You can try to convict him. You can try to convict him. No one has the balls to take him to court. No one has the balls to take him to court.
Now, me, if you ask me, I think this is extremely dangerous. It's inflaming. Imagine you've had neo-Nazis now, you know, mocking the Holocaust and what had happened to the Jews. I mean, the world would be an uproar. And these people are, you know, popular singers and celebrities. What are your thoughts? I was shocked when I heard this.
Yeah, it is. It is sad and it is shocking. But it is one of the means that's been used over centuries, over the years. Carry out genocide. As I said earlier, the apparatus that committed this wasn't just military. There was a propaganda machine behind it. There was Milosevic and his fomenting the masses to hate Muslims. He played on the trope of the Kosovo Polje and the Ottoman Empire and the massacre, the beating that the Serbs had taken. In that military conflict against the Ottomans, I think all of that those tropes, as they're called, these memes and themes, are massively fed to the population to foment hatred, and at the same time, war criminals are glorified. In that last song you played, that you know, my father is a war criminal. They want to bring him to court and try to bring him to court if you can.
You understood it without the translation being said, right? You understood it because you speak Bosnian. Have you ever heard this song before?
No, not the one about the father. That's the first one for me. It's the first time I've heard it. So, but these songs were part of the culture, and are being
part of the culture.
Yeah.
Wow.
Since the Second World War, many of them were formed. You showed images and pictures from the time of the Second World War when the Chetniks had first formed under Draža Mihailović. The Drina River during the Second World War was flowing with Bosnian blood. People were beheaded and thrown into the river, sadly. That cultural aspect of genocide carried itself all the way through, was revived by Milosevic in a very powerful and destructive way, and it continues today because we don't have a law that across Europe and internationally forbids or prohibits the denial of the Bosnian genocide. It's time that law is enacted. It's time that communities of good conscience, nations, and the United Nations embrace something like this. And the powers that sit in the Security Council have to come to their senses to no longer veto these kinds of resolutions when they're brought up. This is the only way that we're going to prevent this culture from continuing to sort of foment and grow the apparatus that committed this genocide. So that's what it's sadly all about. And children are being fed this, which makes it really dangerous.
Yeah, that's why when we open up the show, when you have an influential figure like the figure that we showed, that hopefully this can get to him and he can shift his and retract his the wrong position that he's taken. Let me get your reaction here. This was shocking here. The Serbian Chetnik has joined the Israeli army to participate in the genocide in Palestine and Gaza. The Chetniks were an ultra-Serbian nationalist militia who had committed horrific crimes against the Bosnian Muslims in the Balkans during World War of the 1940s and 1990s. The relationship between Israel and Serbia goes back to 1990s. Israel not only provided them with weapons and ammunition, many Israeli volunteered in Serb forces in their aggression against Kosovo. Mossad reportedly armed and funded Serbian. What do you think when you see this?
Well, I mean, look, right now what's happening over there is a very, very complex and difficult situation that cannot be expressed in a meme or in a soundbite. These sort of images that you're seeing of propaganda of one kind or another, trying to create correlations between wars and between genocides and so on, they're not simple matters. You cannot describe them in a meme or in a text message of 160 SMS characters. They require really deep, deep understanding of what's happening. And yeah, there are political motivations. When people are motivated politically, when they are brainwashed, when they're massively inundated with culture that calls for the destruction of a particular group of people or vilifies or demonizes a population, these are going to be the outcomes. We saw this during the Second World War. We saw it during the Bosnian genocide. We see it today in the Russia-Ukraine war, and we see it in Israel-Palestine. It's a really sad state of affairs when it comes to that, but this is how motivations encourage people to do things that are horrific. And these kinds of memes that call for the destruction or that imply hatred, they're really bad, and they end up fueling others to do the same. We need to take every precaution to make sure that they don't happen, and when they do, we need to call them out.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, with all your experience? You were there during the war in Bosnia. You were there during the genocide. You experienced firsthand. What do you think? For me speaking, I just came from my trip, speaking to different academics and people from there. They're thinking that this can potentially be the next Gaza. Not if, but when. What do you think?
You mean the denial of genocide in Bosnia and Herzegovina?
Yeah, another what happened in the early 90s, happening or worse, if groups like the Chetniks, if they have their way, if they're not... You know, as we as a collective humanity, a force to just like the way, you know, we come up and as Muslims, people who are claiming hijacking Islam, Daesh and these extreme groups, Muslims be the first ones to come up. We need good Serbian people. We need people who want to live together in peace to come out and to within their own to dig out these evil groups who are inciting hate and violence and possibly another genocide happening.
I believe, and I choose to continue to believe, that there are good people everywhere and that their intentions are to try to do good. One of the things that we as an international community, and certainly our leaders, our nation leaders can do, is they can start disincenting destructive outcomes. When you take away the incentive, the sort of carrot that dangles in front, you know, the carrot that, oh, a segment of Bosnia can be carved out, and then the carrot of Greater Serbia being formed or a part of Herzegovina being annexed into Croatia. When you take away those incentives, then the population has to sort of react differently. That's where you enable those people that have good intentions to come into positions of leadership, to come into positions of influence and start influencing the masses. And that's how you're able to sort of contain or corral these apparatuses that have been formed over centuries and this culture that's been sort of growing under everybody's radar, this culture of destruction, mass destruction, this culture of genocide. That's how you end up dispelling that. But we haven't taken the first step, which is dispelling the political incentive, like taking that motivation away from those political forces. So that's one of the things that Dayton has tried to do, but it has almost never been enforced. So sadly, we end up looking at Dayton and saying, well, it's a failed instrument of peace. Its primary goal was to make sure that they don't shoot at each other, and it certainly has achieved that over 30 years. We haven't seen militias engage in any significant way, but we've been seeing the formation of alternatives to the Chetnik forces that came into Bosnia and Herzegovina and you know, rebelled against the sovereign state of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Those alternatives need to be quelled, and they need to be managed. They're not.
Do you think if you had a chance to meet with Dodik or some of the people from the that side, and then you show them, because they really look up to Putin, don't they? They really admire, and that's like their leader. And if you show them, say, hey, look, Putin, he's here showing respect. Not that we endorse Putin or anybody, but he's kissing the Quran. So we're not asking you to kiss the Quran, but make peace with your neighbor. Maybe read the Quran and try to work together so something like this doesn't happen again. You think they could take it, that example from him?
Absolutely. I mean, any viable faith that we've seen, be it Orthodox Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, all of these faiths really try to create a social atmosphere for coexistence, for tolerance, for each group trying to achieve its aspirations. You know, embracing any of them is part of your philosophy or ideology is going to lead to goodness. There's no doubt about that. But with Dodik and you know, Serbian leaders, the message I would bring to them today is that genocide denial is actually harmful to the Serbian population. It ends up continuing this narrative of demonization and hatred. The longer you carry hatred in your heart or in your mind, even if it's hidden, the more destruction it's going to cause and harm to your own society. The shame of what happened in Srebrenica and Tomasica and Prijedor, all over Bosnia Herzegovina, the siege of Sarajevo, the attacks in Herzegovina from the HVO, the Croatian militia, all of the shame that's associated with these acts of aggression and crimes that were committed are going to be carried by generations, the next generations of those groups. And that shame is something that these leaders today can minimize, they can mitigate by coming out and admitting that, yes, these were the Chetniks that committed this, these were the Ustasha that committed these crimes, and distancing themselves from that and talking about remorse and regret and expressing reparations, even if they're symbolic, to say that we acknowledge what had happened, and we will take all of the measures that we need to in order to ensure that they don't happen again. We want to live in peace. We want our Bosnian neighbors to be as successful as we are so that we can thrive in a regional economy that grows. Not this, you know, constant threat and, you know, saber rattling, as they used to say in the old days, continuing to threaten your neighbors and then expecting to have positive economic and diplomatic outcomes that come out of it. The Balkans are falling behind because of this. Bosnia and Herzegovina and its neighbors are well behind Europe in terms of all of the growth and development, modernization that we're seeing, new technologies, artificial intelligence, and all of these developments. Yeah, there are pockets of people trying to do these kinds of things, but they're not going to come about in isolation. No nation in Europe has the resources to develop, for instance, modernized technology, such as space programs and quantum computing and so on. These all come as a result of cooperation. You can't cooperate while somebody's rattling a saber, threatening your sovereignty or your biological existence of your race. Move that out of the way and enable cooperation. That's the conversation that I'd be having with the leaders today, is to say, take the shame away from the next generations. Don't make your grandchildren pay for what your parents and grandparents did.
Just one point that came to my mind before we conclude. I was putting together a documentary, and then the people that I interviewed, and just many on and off camera that I spoke to, and I asked them, does your religion, Islam, teach you just to hate someone because they're Christian or because they're Serb? And these are people who just went through war. And I mean, this is not like half 50-50 or 70, you know, 40. It's pretty much across the board. It was like, no, we don't just hate someone because they're now another religion or because they're Serb or Croatian or whatnot. But it seems like the hate is really coming from the other side. You know, labeling people Turks when they're Bosnian and labeling them whatever names, terrorists, this, that, and the other. But they're projecting, you know, and they're actually fueling. There's within their circles, I don't know if you heard stories like this, and they'll sit at a table and they'll say, leave an empty chair, and they say, your grandfather, this person would have been sitting here if the Muslims didn't X, Y, and Z, you know, eradicate him, the Turks and whatnot. So this fueling. And then you also have, if you are aware, in these convicted war criminals in the RS, they're actually now teaching in the syllabus, the curriculum, history, and they're praising these war criminals. I mean, this is just mind-blowing. Your thoughts when you hear this?
Yeah, it is really mind-blowing to think that war criminals are being included in nursery rhymes, and you know, buildings and roads and infrastructure are being named after them. This has to end. It absolutely has to stop in order for those societies to progress. It's one thing for the victims to call for it. It's another thing for the bystanders, those nations that were either complacent or complicit during the genocide, to call for it. And so this is something that we as society can certainly press those nations to say, you know, put an end to this cultural hijacking that's taking place by this apparatus that committed genocide. And all of these cultural misgivings, the songs that are being played and that are being written and that are being popularized, the glorifying of war criminals, glamorizing of people that have committed uncountable atrocities that are so horrific. I think all of that needs to come to an end. And certainly faith can play a much stronger role in it. And all churches and mosques, leaders can play a much stronger role in it. The church and the mosque, the faith is the moral compass of society. And if that moral compass isn't pointing in the right direction, and the leaders that hold that moral compass aren't continuing to tend to their flock, as Jesus would say, the flock of congregation, the masses that follow that faith, it is the obligation of those leaders. Then those leaders have failed. They've failed in their mission, their purpose, their faith, their commitment to their God. They have failed in their commitment to their people and their followers. It's time for accountability. And I think as a society, we can start holding church leaders accountable for ensuring that the moral compass is pointing in the right direction, and that their masses are trying to understand that moral compass and the direction that they should be going in. It's certainly not glamorizing war criminals.
And when you mentioned church, what came to mind to go ahead and just affirm what I had been saying is that, you know, if Muslims really hated and had these teachings of just, you know, hate them because they're Christian, those 600 plus churches that are still standing in Bosnia after the war, can you testify to that? You know, that they weren't touched, but mosques were just, they were just leveled to the ground. I mean, this is a standing evidence. This is an evidence, you know, to really show, you know, the teachings of Islam that, you know, preserve these churches.
Look, no faith calls for massive destruction of religious artifacts, mm-hmm. and sites. The church happens to be sort of a symbol of part of the ritual of a faith and the belief system of a group of people. The destruction of a symbol of faith is never condoned, and it never should be in any faith. As Muslims, the drive for peace is fundamental. We are all created by exactly the same God, by exactly the same almighty power. And that creation, we've been told explicitly, and in so many ways and over so many centuries, that creation is commanded to respect itself, to respect each other. Part of that respect has to include the idea that people will have differing rituals, that they will have differing faiths, that they may have a different confession, a different a belief system. And when they have that, our job continues to be to respect it as we respect our own, because in as much as we respect them, we expect them to respect ours also. That's how societies are formed. That's probably the fundamental basis of civilization, is mutual respect for each other. It's fundamental, not just to Islam, but to Christianity also.
And that's why Sarajevo was considered, is still considered, the Jerusalem of Europe. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, the phrase of the Jerusalem of Europe is really interesting. Before the Second World War, I don't know if you or many of your viewers know this, Sarajevo had more synagogues and Hadassah houses, places of Jewish practice of the Jewish faith, than Jerusalem did at that time. During the Second World War, those were shut down and they were destroyed and damaged by the Ustasha, the sort of Croat collaborators of the Nazis. And Bosnia had more mosques per square kilometer than Cairo, Egypt. When you start thinking about this melting pot of Orthodox and Catholic and Islam, Muslim churches, mosques, and Jewish synagogues, you see this incredible mosaic, probably one of the richest mosaics on the planet. And over these centuries and over the years, sadly, that mosaic has been wiped out, destroyed, continually hammered, and fires fueled around it to break it up into something that today Bosnians have, during that last war, preserved with 100,000 of their lives. I was in Sarajevo when the Vjesnica was bombed. That night, I was there, and I was sitting in my room in the Holiday Hotel with my video camera, complete shock, because I couldn't imagine that a library was being bombed and shelled with incendiary grenades. They set the place on fire, and when the professors, the teachers, the academics, and the firefighters and the custodians of that place ran in to try to save, 15 million manuscripts were housed in this building, and they were all set ablaze by the Chetniks. When they tried to save these and bring them out, snipers sat in the hills on top and in tops of apartment buildings and started shooting at the people who were just trying to save manuscripts. The Vjesnica had one of the largest collections of Hellenic illuminated art in all of Europe. It's destroyed. The loss was massive of culture and history. So the attack in Bosnia-Herzegovina tried to completely level this very rich fabric of multiculturalism, multi-religious coexistence and peaceful existence that had happened. Don't forget, when the Jews were expelled in the 14th century from Spain and from Portugal by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, and the Muslims that were with them at the time, they were brought to Bosnia-Herzegovina and they settled in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the time of the Ottoman Empire. Sultan Bezeddin had settled them. There's a very famous Bosnian song that most Bosnians know, Kad ja prođem na Bembašu, it's called Kad ja prođem. This is an old Sephardic tune that was created, and it sort of symbolically tells the story of the Sephardic Jews and how they had been salvaged from Spain and Portugal, brought to Thessalonica, where they went with their, as the song says, with the Bielijani. The song is about a boy who comes and brings a white lamb to a girl because he's professing her love for her and he wants to marry her. This is symbolically the Jews coming and trying to be settled in Thessalonica. And when they were kicked out of Thessalonica, they came to Bosnia and Herzegovina, and they thrived there as a community for centuries, co-mingled and coexisted. And that was wiped out during the Second World War, much as the Muslim coexistence and tolerance was attempted to be wiped out during the War of the 1992s and the genocide across Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Well, you just dispelled the myth that Islam teaches Muslims to just hate Jews when you have the Muslims who are taking in Jews, saving the Jews in Muslim land there in Bosnia. Very interesting.
Eddie, this conversation has inspired me somewhere down the line to write a book. I'm going to call it Religion Hijacked. I really believe that this is something.
Our conversation inspired you to that? Very nice. Good.
I think it has. And maybe this is the place for me to put my foot in my mouth and say, one day I'm going to write this book. What you're describing.
This history is very important. The Bogomils, you know, the how they came to accepting Islam, this history of Muslims saving the Jews in Bosnia. This is important information. You need to get out.
Did you know that Muslims around the world protected hundreds of thousands of Jews from being killed by the Nazis?
You had Muslims here in Sarajevo, in Bosnia, that they were actually helping. Talk to you about that history. They were helping to save the Jews, going to the extent of even putting them in niqab, wearing the Islamic dress. Is that?
Yes. During the World War II, the Muslims and the Bosniaks people in Sarajevo, in the whole Bosnia and Herzegovina, are protecting the Jews. Wearing the niqab, wearing the especially niqab.
Yeah.
Was the
they would
the
put they would
they put on the Jewish and
Muslims would put this on the Jews.
On this way, the helping to not kill the Sakati.
To hide the Jews.
Hide in his house. Yes.
Yeah, I think the description of how the Jews, there's a wonderful book that was written. It's by Geraldine Brooks. It's called The People of the Book, and it sort of tells the story of the Sarajevo Haggadah and how this book is from the 13th and 14th century.
The Haggadah,
Haggadah. It was preserved during the Second World War by an imam who took it to a mosque. And hid it among the Qurans because while the Nazis were looking for Jewish literature to burn it and eradicate it, they wouldn't find it because this was hidden among Islamic books. And then when the war was over, the imam brought it and presented it back to, I think it was the museum at the time. The man's name was Dervish Korkut. He was the assistant deputy director, I think was his title, of the museum that had the Haggadah. He actually hid the book in the nape of his pants, and he put his jacket over his body, and he buttoned it up, and he went downstairs and he met with the Nazi colonel that had come for the Haggadah to destroy it. And he said, look, he lied. He said the book has been taken by another officer of the Third Reich. And then he drove in his car and he took it up to a mountain village and gave it to the imam for safekeeping. So my point is that there are exemplary narratives that come out of our history that we can look at and talk about how beautiful and wonderful life is when faiths collaborate, when people collaborate and protect each other. That's what civilization is all about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. It was nice talking with you here, spending some time with you. Appreciate it. Inshallah, we maybe one day see each other in Bosnia.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. And if I've said anything that offended anybody, I apologize. But I truly believe that peace is possible. We just need to work hard at it.
Yes, let's make the peace happen. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you so much, Baba. Salam. Thank you.
I cannot leave without giving you a gift. If you're not yet Muslim and you're tuning in to see what these Muslims are talking about and you like a free copy of the Quran, go ahead and visit thedeanshow.com. We'll take care of the postage and everything and get it delivered to you. And if you still have some questions about Islam, call us at 1-800-662-4752. We'll see you next time. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum. And if you like this episode of The Dean Show, like this video, share this video far and wide, and support us on our Patreon page so we can continue this work. Thank you for tuning in. Peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.